We've seen as we've looked at the book of Ecclesiastes that there's been a real sense in which Solomon does make progress. He experiences, he looks at things, and he draws conclusions. And he actually says, and this is something that is not always noted with the book, well, life can be enjoyed. There's some good stuff that goes on. God is good. He does give gifts to men and women, boys and girls. There's a sense that even the drudgery of things, well, work can be good. Food and drink and enjoyment, family, things like that. Fellowship with other people, great. It can all be enjoyable. But he's also aware that sometimes you need a different perspective. We saw that he was looking at the whole way even good things can get messed up by the wrong attitude. Saw that last week in chapter 5, didn't we? He saw that wealth wasn't always a good thing. It could be hoarded to the harm of its owner. And so, when we get to chapter 6, he does something which we've started to see him do partially before. He steps into another person's shoes. And this is important, isn't it? And it's important we have to remember what we've seen so far in the book, because we could actually look at this chapter and completely misunderstand it. If we preach it as a standalone sermon, unless we get the context right, unless we note what he's said so far, we could get a very distorted view of everything that's going on. Some years ago, there was a program called Mr. Ben. Now, Tracy used to watch it, and I've quizzed her a bit on it recently. I never saw it, but I knew the gist of it. And Mr. Ben was a guy who used to wear a bowler hat. And I said to Tracy, did he have some kind of ordinary job? Was he an accountant? Because I saw pictures of him. He looked a bit like an accountant. And she said, yeah, he was something like that. Well, he used to daydream, and he used to sort of think, well, today I'll be a medieval knight, or I'll be an astronaut. And interesting enough, we were out on a walk a few days ago, I can't remember, and I said, I think for a kid's program, it's pretty disturbing. He must have been deeply unhappy with his life if he kept on sort of imagining his other people. And Tracy said, yeah, it's a bit creepy, isn't it? I didn't see that as a kid. Well, these things are often quite subliminal, aren't they? But he is quite useful to us here, because I think, in a sense, this is what Solomon tends to do at points in the book. He puts himself in other people's shoes. Some people have said that it couldn't possibly be written by Solomon, Ecclesiastes, because he is critical of authority at various times within the book. Well, no, I think he just takes a step back and says, well, let's just, if I imagine I'm not king, and I was rather than up here, I was down here in the lower strata of society. How would I see that? Well, chapter 6 is a particular example of that. He now steps completely back and thinks, let's, in a sense, forget what I've been saying. It still exists, it's still true. But how would it be if I didn't see everything as from the hand of God? How would life appear to me if I was someone who thought like that? Some years ago, a group called The Verb wrote a song called A Bittersweet Symphony, which was a rather large hit. And the first line was this: it's a bittersweet symphony called life, trying to make ends meet. You're a slave to money, then you die. Now, that could be one interpretation of what we've been reading so far. And it would certainly seem to be an interpretation of chapter 6. So here Solomon gives a dispassionate observation. And the first thing he wants to note is this. This is what it's like if you are a slave to a Genesis 3 world. Now let's just recap what that means. back in chapter 1, when he was sort of laying out his whole idea of this pursuit of wisdom, he had noted, as he said, he devoted himself to study, this is 1:13, to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven, what a heavy burden God has laid on men. And we've looked at what that meant. It means to put us back into Genesis 3. It's to look at mankind's fall, mankind's sin, and God's judgment. This is the heavy burden. Adam used to work the garden. It was a joy. It was a privilege. They were in beautiful surroundings. And because of his sin, you know, God basically says it's not going to be the giggle anymore. It's going to be tough. There's going to be thorns and thistles. You can see that if you're making notes. It's Genesis 3, 17 and 18. It's going to be tough. You're going to work by the sweat of your brow. It's not going to be enjoyable. Now, to get, again, important we remember, Solomon has pointed out God's gifts are good. He's done it three times. We can go back through the book, 15, 18 to 20. 3. Chapter 3, verse 12, and 2, 24 and 25. Basically, he said, yes, there are good things. God can enable men to enjoy their work. He can enable them to enjoy the fruits of their work. But it's also come off a theme in chapter 5 that there's a danger. If these things become too important in themselves, then actually they become a problem rather than good gifts from God. If you make an idol of work, if you make an idol of money, you cut God out of the equation, there's a problem. Okay, now let's just imagine that, he says for a second. Imagine this. Imagine if you're in a world and you fail to see what God gives you. And that's what we see here. Basically, in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, this is the burden that weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions and honour, so he lacks nothing his heart desires, but God does not enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. Let's unpack that a little bit, because it's a little bit complicated. All good things come from God. In fact, everything comes from God. There's a sense in which that's true. He is sovereign. And so here's someone who's been given everything, but he cannot enjoy them. Why can't he enjoy them? Remember the context, Genesis 3. He can't enjoy them because he's become a slave to them, as we've seen in chapter 5. And there's a rather interesting scenario here. Others benefit. There's rather interesting film we saw the other day. It acts as a partial example. It's that lovely film, Remains of the Day, with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. And one of the things that's very interesting about that is, although it's quite a sad sort of picture of the relationship and an unfulfilled relationship, is the Anthony Hopkins character, the chief butler. He revels in his role. He loves his little world. He's got a lord over him who, rather interestingly, sees himself as a bit of a mover and shaker, and in the end, because he's so sort of concerned about politicising before the war, he's seen as a Nazi sympathiser, and in his life is ruined. But Hopkins, as the man sort of under him, as the chief butler, enjoys, he loves his little world. That's the picture here, isn't it? There's someone in a big company, at the top of a company, they've got all the worries and stuff like that going on. But you can sometimes get, it's not always the case, people do seem to think, I remember a friend of mine saying once that he knew that he didn't know. He was working in telecom at the time when it's expanding rapidly in the 80s. And he said that everyone would be okay if they had a job above them. But the point is this: there can be some people who sort of reach a point and they've got so much responsibility, they quite enjoy their job, and they don't have the responsibility of the men at the very top. A stranger enjoys them. Now, Solomon looks at that and says, well, that's a grievous evil. It is, isn't it? It's a result of the fall. There's a pointlessness to that as well, isn't it? It's not God who's the problem, it's man. If we leave God out, if we're not going to navigate the world with God, we're going to get problems. It will affect our view of the world, and that's basically what 3-6 is about. Interestingly, in the Old Testament, what we see in these verses, long life, many children, prosperity, these things were often seen as a blessing from God. Just think of Abraham. Think of any of the patriarchs, to be honest. Think of Job with his possessions. People looked at them and they said, look at all this stuff Job's got. He's been blessed by God. And actually, as we know the book, when they were all taken away, everyone said, well, he's not blessed by God anymore. He's done some grievous sin, which wasn't quite the truth, was it? People would have looked at such a man and said, oh, look, you know, he's so blessed. He's so blessed. And Solomon says to you, but actually you can have all this stuff and you can't enjoy it properly because you do not understand where it comes from. You do not understand who is the provider. Now, just to apply that a bit to us today, can we sometimes feel owed because of our service to God? It is a problem, isn't it? We try to be faithful. We try to preach the gospel. We try to witness. We sometimes find that barriers just go up all around us. And for many, many years, we sort of go through that. And sometimes it's, and I can understand it, it's human nature. I feel it myself from time to time. We think, God, why not? Why can't we make some impression? Why aren't people responding? That can be a case in many churches, large and small. It's interesting. I was talking to a friend who's in an ESCT church. It's quite a large church. And he was saying how little progress they'd seen in the last 7 years since he'd been there as minister and how it grieved him. And we need to protect ourselves from that, don't we? We can actually get into that sort of Old Testament mindset. We think God owes us. Well, the tragedy is when God gives all these things and we don't actually give thanks for him. The tragedy is when we don't even see what we might see as small blessings and we don't give thanks. The tragedy is when we don't see that God maintains a witness in Stony Stratford through the work of this church. And he's continuing to do it, and God willing, he will continue to do it. There's a tragedy. That's a tragic sense of things, isn't it? We need, and we should, and it's right to see God's hands in the many blessings we see, even though not the kind of size blessing we perhaps would like. Frances Rivergill Havergal was noted for keeping a mercy diary. She was a great hymn writer. But apparently she used to jot down each day blessings she'd seen from God in good and bad times. And that's something, isn't it? It's the old chorus, isn't it? Count your blessings one by one. And it sort of says something, I can't remember the right words, but then you will be surprised at what God has done. Let's not be someone who is a slave to a Genesis 3 word. It is possible, even as Christians, and it can stifle us. Secondly, there's a danger of being a slave to our covetous nature. It's rather interesting that do not covet comes at the end of the commandments, because it's a command that covers many things. In a sense, it covers everything. Because we covet what we see around us, don't we? Even if we don't act on it. You may have a desire for the next door neighbour's car, latest gadget, whatever. But Solomon is wise, and he realised that people who do such things are never satisfied. Verse 7, all a man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. I think he is sort of talking both in the working for food and sustenance, but he's thinking, I think, in a wiser sort of view than that. What advantage has a wise man over the fool? Well, wisdom will get you so far, won't it? But it won't do everything. It won't cover that want or need or hunger that we have for things we see around us each day. Leave God out of the equation, there'll be a problem, won't there? And actually, it doesn't make a difference whether we're wise or foolish. Verse 8, doesn't matter, does it? There's no advantage. If we don't know how to conduct ourselves in relation to God, then we've got a problem. Rather, Solomon says, and here he hits a positive, be content by what is right in front of you. In other words, be content with what you see in your own backyard. Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. Don't seek things out. That's being covetousness, isn't it? The hankering, the dwelling on things. Better to be content with what you've got around you. And again, although it's not so much in the text here, but to apply it to us today, better to be content and give God thanks for it than what we might imagine or we might crave. That will only lead to immense disappointment. You see, in the end, Solomon sums it up. If we have this sort of thing, if we are always looking to be satisfied or thinking there'd be one extra thing, then we are actually chasing the wind again, this Hebrew word, hebel. We're going after something that's mist and vapour, something that will evaporate as soon as we think we can grab it in our hands. Now, what foolishness is that? So he's warned us about being a slave to a Genesis 3 world. He's warned us of the sin of covetous nature that can come out of that. And lastly, he says, if you're going to be a slave, here's a big warning. God stands behind the natural order and the human dimension or progress, verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man has been known is, sorry, and what man is has been known, no man can contend with one who is stronger than he. In the end, God is behind everything. You know, we can have so much knowledge, we can know a certain amount, but in a sense, God has put the order in place. Whatever exists has already been named. God set up this world. He gave it a natural order. And in the end, he has real wisdom. We can't contend with him, can we? We can't find real meaning without him. Just recently, it's one of these rather interesting things, and I believe it's quite rare now. Back in the 70s, into the 70s, there was a Christian group, progressive group, called After the Fire, which I was very fond of. And they actually did something which is quite common now. They sponsored their first album, raised money, printed 4,000 copies, sold them very quickly among their fans. And later they went on to have some much more success, actually. But rather interestingly, I listened to that again. I got it on CD recently. I have it on vinyl as well, which apparently, as I said, is a collector's item now. And I was struck by the lyrics. The lyrics were very much 70s. And I think they very much show us, as we've gone through a mind change of worldview here. The 70s were very much this, that basically You could be discontent, you would be depressed with life, and somehow you would find God. This would spur you to look for God. Now, brothers and sisters, I don't think that's really the case now. That is not the case. You see, this verse 10, I think, sets out that we cannot contend with God. We cannot find true contentment. We can put band-aids on, mental ones, emotional ones. And that, I think, is what we do now. People create meaning. There's a very notable multi-stranded film called Hannah and Her Sisters by the filmmaker Woody Allen. And at one point, one of the characters tries to commit suicide. And in typical comic fashion, he puts the gun to his head. He's sweating so much, it comes off his head, it goes off, it misses. And he rushes out, because the neighbours are wondering what's going on. He rushes out, and he just walks and walks and walks, and he goes into a movie theatre. And he sees a film. It's a Marx Brothers film. It's Duck Soup, which is very funny. And he watches this, and as he slowly watches this, he sort of says, well, you know, looking at this silliness on the screen, you know, the tragedy, the tragicomedy of life, wouldn't you want to go around once and experience it? If that's all there is. And that, I think, is a very common view today. Rather interestingly, when another film came out called You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, again directed by Woody Allen, Woody Allen said in an interview, where there's ceased to be a belief in a God, people are now creating their own spiritual reality. Or they're creating their own sort of world view. We create to basically replace. And I think that's the case, isn't it? But actually, when that's stripped away, we realise the world is a pretty messed up place. It's not totally without good things. Solomon has seen that. Even in a sin-damaged world, good stuff exists. God is good. We can be blessed by him. What does he come to the conclusion in the end? Well, can we find meaning? Verse 11 answers that one. The more words, the less meaning. And how does that profit anyone? Yes, people can come up with all kinds of philosophical answers. They can look at things. They can try and do it. The fact is this, we realise in the end, we've all got the same fate. He touched on it back there when he talked about the stillborn child. We will all die. And actually, if you take a humanist view, if you take an atheist view, that actually renders most of what we do completely meaningless. There is no meaning. We can try and create it. Like I was saying, I think last week, I had a friend who once said he wanted to have children. I said, well, you're not married yet. Why do you want to have children? You know, he said, well, I want to leave something of myself in life. You see how desperate that is to try and sort of create meaning. I said, well, Tracy and I haven't got children, but you know, if we did have children, why would I want to leave a second Keith Plant with all his flaws in the world? Rather, I raise them as a Christian parent. I give them the values and stuff like that, and I expect them to sort of develop their identity as Christians. That's what we want to do. We don't want duplicates of ourselves. But can you see the flaw in that? It's what we tend to sometimes do because we say that gives us meaning. Very Greek, isn't it? You know, as long as the name was remembered, the person would somehow spiritually continue to exist. We can't, but God can. Verse 12, as I said, take this out of context and it can read completely differently, but we know that Solomon has said there is meaning. For who knows what is good for a man's life during the few meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he's gone? The point is, he knows that God can. God can. And that's the encouragement, isn't it? In Romans chapter 11, this is how Paul praises God. when he looks at God's divine plan for redemption of people. Chapter 11, 33 to 36. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths before tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory for ever. Amen. Now, the point is this, and there's a lot that could be said about these marvellous verses, but the point is this. God knows. No one can tell God. No one can counsel God. Human wisdom will inevitably fall very, very short. Because he is the omnipotent, the sovereign God. For from him, through him, and to him are all things. And that's the key, isn't it? Step outside yourselves. Solomon will do this throughout the book. He will step between two views. But he actually wants us to concentrate on what God gives and God's blessing. What's Paul's conclusion after that outburst of praise? Well, we find it in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Only God can transform the mind so we get a proper world view. If we continue to live according to this world, we will have a distorted view, just as the shoes, just as the Solomon does, as he puts himself in this other man's shoes with the godless world view. We won't be able to enjoy. We're not to conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but to be transformed. When our mind is renewed, we will see God and give him his proper place. And we will experience so much more, because we will see so much more good and realize it flows from him. And of course, the ultimate expression of that is the cross. The cross is the ultimate expression, because we cannot experience any good from God unless we are first forgiven. Let's pray.